Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WMYC app, our website at WMYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although many workers may be aware or at least suspect that their email and web use are being monitored by their employers, what they probably don't know is just how extensive it has become. Workforce management companies like Kronos, which is part of an $11 billion industry, can measure every aspect of a worker's life affecting their pay, hours, review, and future employment. Here to discuss just how intrusive workplace monitoring has become is Esther Kaplan, whose article, The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You write that you got interested in a data-driven workforce because of your experiences with UPS deliveries? What's the connection?
I found that I was having trouble getting my UPS deliveries, and even when I was home, there would sometimes be a delivery attempt slapped on the door. There seemed to have been no attempt to actually ring the bell and bring the package upstairs. And in the process of talking to a labor organizer who works with UPS workers, I found that they are actually the guinea pigs. They're kind of in the avant-garde of telematics, which is a system that can minutely observe them. 200 sensors on their trucks, additional sensors on that handheld dyad, and that it's resulted in this incredible work speed up. And the result, of course, or maybe not, of course, but in fact, has been the shortcuts. Drivers are trying to trim any extra motion out of their day in order to meet these brutal new quotas.
And the telematics is actually a neologism derived from the words telecommunications and informatics. But you mentioned dyads. What are they?
Delivery information acquisition device. This is the realm of crazy neologisms and acronyms. Everything in this field is actually quite new because none of this incredible data gathering was possible even 8 or 10 years ago because the prices of RFID devices, another radio frequency information device, another great acronym, data storage, data processing, GPS, all this stuff was too expensive for companies to be adopting this on a wide level until extremely recently.
So if a UPS driver decides to stop for a cup of coffee, the boss back at the office knows?
Yeah, well, they know that they stopped for 4 minutes and 32 seconds, and if that's beyond their quota, yeah, they might get pulled in and questioned about it.
Could they be fired?
Well, UPS drivers are represented by a union. A lot of the workers I looked at in this piece are not. As we all know, unionization numbers are way down.
But they're with the Teamsters, a very powerful union. Why would the union even allow this kind of monitoring?
Well, the unions had a lot of battles over it in negotiations. They ultimately allowed it to go through. They did win contract language that says that you can't be fired exclusively based on your telematics report. And these are, a single shift can generate a 40-page report on your every move. It's almost impossible for many of us to imagine being observed that minutely. But what's happened is that an employee might get called in based on a telematics report, then they're interviewed about what happened, and then if they're caught in some inconsistency with the report, they can then be fired for lying. So there are lots of telematics-related firings, but there's always some additional bit of criteria being used in the firing that passes the literal muster of the contract.
Weren't the dyads sold to the drivers as a way to improve safety? Does it?
Yes. The system was designed to improve safety, or so they were told. And when it was introduced, there were all kinds of signs around the workplace about increasing seatbelt use and decreasing backup time and all that. UPS claims that seatbelt use has risen under this system. But what I found from this plethora of driver online forums where they all post their frustrations with the system and talking with employees and union organizers is that that may be a complete fiction. Drivers are buckling their seatbelts behind their backs in order because they know the telematics is going to pick up on their seatbelt use.
And they want to jump out of the truck as quickly as possible.
And jump right back in as quickly as possible. And if they save that buckling and unbuckling each time, their numbers look better. They're over-under number.
How many deliveries are UPS drivers expected to make on a typical run? Obviously, you said in your case, they didn't even bother to find out if you were home. They just simply slapped the notice on the door. We've all had that experience.
Well, if you save a couple minutes that way at each stop. So, I mean, one driver I talked to in New York City, his stop count per shift, and each stop could have multiple addresses. That's just each truck stop. The routes are very carefully planned. Went from 85 to 90 to 100, is now up to 110 just in the last 15 years. So, and if you look at UPS's corporate filings, you'll see that domestic package deliveries since they introduced telematics went up by 1.5 million additional packages with fewer drivers. So there's an intense speed up going on in the ranks that's been facilitated by this technology.
I'm speaking with Esther Kaplan, whose article, The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. You write that the UPS workforce has also been cut. Because these things speed everything up, they feel they don't need as large a workforce?
Yeah, they're just more packages per route. The idea is to eliminate even seconds of inefficiency out of each day. And they're constantly, UPS is in the process of rolling out a new telematics system they call Orion that's going to be adjusting drivers' routes on the fly throughout the day. So if suddenly there's a scheduled pickup, it'll readjust the route. So they're treating humans as kind of cogs in this machine that they can just squeeze. You know, one driver.
I wonder what happens if they're on the BQE.
Well, I guess they're allowed to be stuck in traffic, but one driver told me that he used to be able to wait around if a customer, a regular customer, was about to get a package ready for pickup, and now he just has to sprint back out the door. So all of these human relationships, of course, get sacrificed along the way.
And UPS is making claims that telematics is not only improving their bottom line, but also the environment. They say that in 2010, telematics saved 1.7 million driving miles, 15 million minutes of idling time, and 103,000 gallons of gas. Is that verifiable?
It seems to be other telematics companies that I talk to are finding similar gains. I think, to me, this is the strongest argument for these systems, is the reduction in fuel costs. The reduction of idling in particular, I think, is quite meaningful when you project it on this large scale. The part that they are not paying as much attention to, and was my focus here, is just what does it mean to be a worker within this intensive electronic monitoring system?
This has been around for a while. Didn't a man named Frederick Taylor come up with something some years back?
Right. That was about standing at the assembly line with a stopwatch and timing how long an activity took and then looking for process improvements to decrease that time. So, yes. But the detailed kind of monitoring was not possible until quite recently.
And we're talking about what's expected to become a $30 billion industry within a few years. You begin your article with Jim Cramer, the host of CNBC's Mad Money, extolling the virtues of workforce monitoring by one of the companies in the field, Cornerstone On Demand. How does a company like Cornerstone or Kronos address the talent, so-called talent, of an employee?
Well, so a lot of this workforce monitoring was introduced with companies with big workforces, hourly wage workers, retail, fast food, warehouse workers, call centers. Obviously, we're at the very early phases of electronic monitoring back in the 90s. But in the last just 3 to 5 years, it's begun to enter the field, our fields, knowledge workers, as we are known. And so now that
is
knowledge,
my boss monitoring me right now?
Well, I think
it's apparent. It's called a radio.
NPR does use Kronos, I think.
Do they?
Which capacities they have turned on, I don't know. So as knowledge began to be viewed as a corporate asset, then the question became, how well are you sharing your knowledge? How quickly are you acquiring knowledge? And all of this, and so much of this happens through digital phone calls, emails, instant messages, and so on. Companies started tracking your networking and evaluating it as a corporate asset.
And you write, every aspect of an office worker's life can now be measured, and an increasing number of corporations and institutions, from cosmetics companies to car rental agencies, are using that information to make hiring and firing decisions. Now, are they telling their workforce that they're doing this? Are people being warned?
They don't have to. There are no federal laws about this. Only 2 states have laws requiring disclosure. So, no, in general, you're not being told. I mean, consultants will say best practice is to alert your employees, but there's no way to know that if you haven't been notified, that you aren't nevertheless being monitored.
Can any web search, phone call, text, email, or post on Facebook be used against an employee, even when they're less inflammatory than the tweet that just got Keith Olbermann suspended from ESPN?
It is all capturable. It is all being captured. The content, I mean, that's been happening for a while, where employers may want to know that you're buying a Christmas gift on Amazon during your work hours or surfing porn, and employees get fired for that sort of thing.
And you say 66% of employers monitor the internet use of their employees. 45% track employee keystrokes. 43% monitor employee email. That's a lot.
And it's way higher now, I would assume. That's an American Management Association survey from half a dozen years ago. They have not done a more recent one. There's no more recent comprehensive academic study. I'm guessing it's almost ubiquitous at this point.
And what would keystrokes tell an employer? Just that you can type faster than I can?
Well, whether you're working. So let's say you take your computer home and you're supposed to be writing up a press release or whatever you're supposed to be doing. They can know on an hourly or minute-by-minute basis if you're really banging it out there.
That's because more and more people are working from home. And they have no way of finding out whether they're actually doing their work or doing something else.
They have every way now, because they can, if it's a work-issued computer, they can absolutely track everything that you're doing on it, even while you're at home. And the academics I've talked to who've studied this say that, with very few exceptions, employers who have the capacity use the capacity.
And they claim that all of this monitoring will make workers more productive. Has that been proven to be the case?
There are examples, definitely. I mean, the UPS example we already discussed, they're getting a tremendous amount of extra work out of each driver. I mean, to the detriment of the drivers with their blown out knees and shoulders and everything else. But yes, they are getting increased work. There was a study of a grocery chain that showed higher scan speeds. There was a study of restaurant chain that showed decreased employee theft due to monitoring. So I think that in certain cases, there are gains. On the other hand, one scholar I talked to said that there's a lot of evidence that with more complex tasks, like, say, you're a driver driving through a complex city streets, that monitoring can impair your performance, because a part of your brain is focused on the fact that you're being observed and measured, and it actually can distract you from appropriate decision making. I mean, almost like texting while driving, that it's just using some bandwidth that you're not applying to the work task.
We'll talk about some other examples and some other problems that are revealed in Esther Kaplan's article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring. We will talk about them after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Esther Kaplan talking about her article, The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring. It's in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. I don't want to beat this horse to death, but there are so many other instances of it popping up, like where warehouse workers are being monitored. They're wearing devices that assign them their tasks and also give them the amount of time they have to complete the task.
Yeah. I mean, there's any little element of human discretion is just being squeezed out of people's workday.
And then there, the monitoring also.
And then let me say about the warehouse workers that now there's talk of fitting workers with augmented reality devices, Google Glass kind of stuff, where they could actually themselves, when they look at a package, it will scan, you know, the RFID code, and it'll all be, you know, that extra minute of looking down or second of looking down at their device will be eliminated. It's a brave new world.
We'll be so efficient, won't we? It's also affecting things like McDonald's, Stop and Shop, Uniqlo. What are they doing there at the point of sale?
Well, so on the one hand, there's monitoring of the individual employee's performance, right? So if I'm a cashier at your local grocery store, it's recording my scan rate. It's recording how often I have to rescan a particular product. It'll notice whether
when you call the manager,
whether everyone's having a rescan problem with that product or just me. My scan rate might be posted in the break room for everyone to see. So there's this intense monitoring on the individual level. And then on the store-wide level, and this is throughout retail and fast food and groceries, this data is being used from the registers about, which they call point-of-sale data, and it's being integrated with vast troves of historical data about when it's raining and when it's snowing and when it's sunny and when there's a Yankees game. And they're trying to create these absolutely maximized schedules so that they don't have an employee on the clock for an extra minute beyond when they need to. So the result has been this crazy. I mean, this is just in the last 5 years where people's schedules have just gone mad, where instead of an 8-hour shift, you get a 3.5-hour shift just during the rush, and then you have to come again for another 3.5 or 4 or 5-hour shift. Or I think even more sinister, really, is these on-call shifts, which we associate with highly skilled people like doctors who actually are compensated. But here you have a minimum wage job, and you're being told to keep your schedule open at almost every hour of the day or night in case they need you, which for a single mother, or, you know, you can imagine.
Well, yeah, there's somebody who has a child who has to then schedule a babysitter or pick the kid up from school or whatever. That would be a real problem. But also some people have two jobs.
Well, right.
Well, happens there if you're on call and you're working the other job? What do you do?
It simply doesn't work. I mean, we've all been aware of this trend for a while now, that minimum wage has not kept pace with cost of living. So low-wage workers routinely have two jobs. A household, there might be 3 or 4 jobs between the two adults in the household. And this stands in the way of that. So it's having a disastrous impact on people's overall income because they can't maintain the job the night manager job at the hotel if they're trying to be available for their Starbucks shifts or their Zara shifts on 1 or 2 days' notice.
Do they take people's sleep schedules into account?
No, they don't. That's actually been a big issue with Starbucks. They call, there's a word for it called a clopen, where you close one night and then you do an opening shift the next day, and there's literally not enough time to get home, get more than a few hours of sleep, and get back for your next shift.
You use the story of
Starbucks
Alice.
Has pledged to try to change that, but
well,
we will see.
You use the story of Allison Santana to explain the new norm of schedules generated out of the workforce cloud-based management systems. Is the new norm what we've been talking about here?
Yeah,
what happened to her?
She's a classic example. Single mom. She now has three kids. She was hired at minimum wage as a Starbucks barista. She thought she just might be able to make ends meet with the 30 hours a week she was promised. But then she didn't get 30 hours. She ended up getting almost all short shifts, these 4 or 5 hour shifts. They rarely added up to more than about 18 hours a week. She had a night job that was not taken into account by the system, even though her manager was made fully aware of it. So she would sometimes get scheduled to show up for an early morning Starbucks shift when her night shift wasn't yet over. And she lost her state-subsidized child care because Starbucks wouldn't give her enough notification of her schedules. And they required the advance notification of her childcare hours. So then she ended up having to saddle her mother, who had her own young children at home, with the childcare. I mean, you could just see the chaos rippling through her life.
We got a call from a UPS driver. I don't know whether they know from the monitoring that he called us in, but he says that you and the article are exactly right. He says they monitor everything down to the way drivers get out of the truck, and he's been called into the office about minor infractions like that.
Yeah, he's not alone, that is for sure.
What happened in August 2013 when the teen fashion chain Forever 21 began using Kronos?
Well, so this is one of the things I was trying to explore in the article. How much of this super, super lean scheduling is just part of the trend in retail, and how much of it relates to these new systems, these electronic systems that are creating these schedules based on these troves of data? So what happened in that case is within 2 weeks of the adoption of the Kronos system, a huge number of the employees got letters saying they were no longer full-time, their health benefits were being terminated, and they were being converted into contract workers, basically. And I talked to employees at another store with 21 in its name, Century 21.
You spoke to, actually, the president of the union, Max Bruni, who represents Century 21 workers. Hey, he told you about the problems they face with Kronos?
Yeah, and I talked to some employees there, too. This was a classic, you know, New York retail store. It's been around for a long time. They had overwhelmingly full-time workers. It was a decent job. It was one of those decent, unskilled jobs that there used to be more of in the city. And Kronos came in, and suddenly all these full-time workers were thrown into part-time and, even more importantly, irregular schedules.
And that includes people who are in the union?
Yeah. I mean, the union kind of stomped its way into the store and made things right. They filed a pile of grievances, and they advocated on behalf of individual worker after individual worker. They ultimately had contract negotiations and won the right to a static, predictable schedule of 40 hours a week for people who have at least 10 years at the store. That's now a perk. I heard of other employees at other stores where, you know, you used to get a bonus if you led sales. Now what you get is hours, you know, you get a 40-hour week. That's the big, you know, carrot at the end of the stick.
All of these programs seem designed to get the last ounce of production out of today's labor force without really considering them as individuals.
Well, one of the things that really struck me is if you look at the rise of these systems, whether it's the big workforce scheduling systems, talent management systems, the telematic systems, it's heavily happened since the financial crash, since 2007 has been the ferocious period of adoption. So it's a period with weak labor unions, with a very slack labor market. So there's just very little pushback on the part of employees to express anything about their demands for a healthy body, for a sane life, their childcare needs. So they've been implemented with just one metric in mind, which is making labor costs more lean.
And that's why, despite the fact that unemployment is going down, average income has remained static, or if anything, is declining.
Yeah, and I think that it's going to be a heavy lift now that these systems have been implemented in this fashion to push back and make them more flexible. The thing is, they're incredible, powerful tools. There's no reason that they couldn't, with all that data they pull in, that they couldn't pull in the data about when someone has childcare and when they don't, or that they have a Tuesday evening night class. There's no reason. It's just that that's not how they have been implemented, in fact.
Kronos' promotional video advertises, in a few minutes late, taking a few extra minutes on a break, it all adds up.
Right. There's a bit of an obsession about time theft by employees, that somehow you're going to get your friend to clock you in and then show up 12 minutes late and you're going to do the same thing. You're going to head out early to pick up your kid and get your friend to clock you out. When I've talked to organizers, employees, and attorneys involved in wage and hour claims, that in fact, it's really the opposite. What these systems seem to be promoting with the obsessive focus on this one metric, keeping your labor costs down, which the systems now turn into this sort of shiny number, and you get alerts if you're above your ideal labor to sales ratio, is wage theft by employers of their employees. That's become rampant.
So they're asking you to be more efficient. In fact, you point out to avoid buddy punching, they've introduced finger scans.
Right.
But how does wage theft work? They're just not giving you the full amount that you earned?
Well, what's happening is, let's say you work a six-hour shift at McDonald's and it's so busy that you never have time to even go to the bathroom, which is routine. I mean, this is part of the work speed up, is the inhumane schedules are so intense that you don't even literally get to take your bathroom break. But then afterward, if that labor number is too high, the manager can just go in the system and put in that unpaid lunch break, even though you didn't take it. Or if suddenly foot traffic in the store or the restaurant goes down by a little bit, you send someone off to the break room and you just make them wait there unpaid, which is illegal. If they're not on the clock, they should be allowed to go home until things speed up, and then you put them back. Or you tell them to clock out, but hey, can you just help mop up that mess in the corner? Or they arrive and you say, wait to clock in, but by the way, can you help get this stuff stocked? So it's just, it's bits and pieces, but it adds up to, like, I talked to one worker, she found in one 2-week pay period, she had 11 hours she'd worked that she wasn't paid for. And she's covering childcare costs
hours. We're talking about fast food and the like, but we just got a call from a listener who said that the same thing happens at Columbia University. So,
do tell.
I guess if you're not tenured, you wind up being treated not all that differently than somebody who works at Safeway or McDonald's. According to a September survey commissioned by Elansodesk and the Freelancers Union, 53 million American workers, that's a third of the U.S. workforce, are now engaged in contract, temporary, or freelance work. Now, we mentioned being monitored from home for keystrokes, but can they be monitored in other ways as well?
Well, yeah. So Odesk is one of the firms I talk about in the piece because they're one of these freelance marketplaces. They recently merged with Elance, which you mentioned co-led that survey. But one of the things they have on offer is this thing called a work diary. So when if I'm doing some freelance copywriting for you and we do it through Odesk, I log into my work diary and then you know you have the assurance of knowing I'm working. I get the assurance that I'm guaranteed pay from you as the client. But what they really offer is your ability to spy on me. So every 10 minutes, within every 10-minute increment, you get a screenshot of my home computer screen.
But didn't you hire someone to do some transcription for this article for you and spy on her? Yeah, I'm sure you did it.
Yes, I did.
The kindness of your heart. It was all research.
I was interviewing a lot of people who worked on Odesk, and I kept trying to get them to describe what exactly this work diary looked like. And finally, I just decided, yeah. So I posted on there for some transcription work. The offers poured in from around the world, including a few dollars an hour in developing nations. I hired an American for well above minimum wage. And yeah, it was a spooky, spooky experience. I could just call up her computer screen on my screen and I could see the transcription unfolding on the page, on my screen. I could see minute by minute the number of keystrokes.
What did you discover? Was she cheating you?
What I discovered was that she was cheating herself, actually. She was not cheating me. I talked to her afterward, and she said that while she typically can transcribe an hour of audio in 4 hours, she then takes an additional hour or hour and 10 minutes to proofread it. But that doesn't involve keystrokes. And she knows if she did that in the Odesk work diary, her activity meter would look really low. It would look really bad. Her metrics would look really bad. So she simply doesn't log in. She does it off the clock. She is not compensated for that time. So she's typically on a job stealing about 20% of her own wages.
So where do we go from here? This sounds so brave new world.
It is. It is brave and new. And we're all
catching up to Aldous Huxley.
I mean, I think one of the things that's troubling here is it's so new and the implementation is so rapid. You know, I went to a fleet management association where telematics was the big thing. And you could just tell that everyone felt like it was keeping up with the Joneses. They have it, so we have to have it. And they weren't going into it with any clear strategic plan, any clear vision for what information they were trying to gather. So this stuff is just being implemented at a rapid fire pace. These industries are growing in the double digits every year. And the consequences to their workforces, the consequences to us socially, not keeping pace. There have been hearings, the FTC has done hearings about collection of consumer data. You know, we've had a big public debate about government collection of data in the wake of Snowden. But this arena of our employers' collection of our data, no one's watching what's going on.
No proposed legislation.
No hearings. No laws.
And I'd imagine in the current political climate, it's unlikely that anybody would even bother because it wouldn't go anywhere.
It would be unlikely. It would be nice if some enterprising people would at least hold some hearings about this.
What kind of feedback have you gotten so far from the article?
Well, I like...
Have you got any pushback from the industry?
Mainly not. I mean, I think that, you know, with Kronos, they feel that that some of the abuses that I document are the result of user error, it's not the result of the system. You know, I would argue that the system facilitates this kind of thing, and they do advertise that what they're offering is their systems will produce the lowest cost solution. And so these pressures that end up on the frontline managers to squeeze those schedules, to push people off the clock, that's going to be the result of these metrics that are produced. And unless, you know, they come up with ways to build in employee concerns in their systems, this is the direction that it's going to take.
I'm going to have to start learning to speak faster.
Yes, you are. I think someone's collecting your words per minute, and it's just not looking good.
Esther Kaplan is the editor of the investigative fund at the Nation Institute. Her article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine is "The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring." Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was such a pleasure. And I have to say, I heard that you are heading for a major anniversary on the air, 30 years. And I think that's just so fantastic. And I wanted to congratulate you. It's an honor to be here.
March 5th. Thank you. David Ives is one of our most inventive and busiest playwrights. At the same time, his verse adaptation of an 18th century play, The Metromaniacs, is up in Washington, D.C. New Yorkers have a chance to see not one, but six short plays of his in One Night on 42nd Street, collected under the title Lives of the Saints. Its run has been extended through March 27th, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. The man who wrote Venus in Fur and All in the Timing. And then two of the thespians from this production, Carson Elrod, who has also been here before, and Liv Ruth, who I'm meeting for the first time.
Hello.
Welcome. David, does it take a different mindset to write one-act plays as opposed to full length?
It takes a shorter pen. I just I use a cut down Bic Blue medium point pen that's about an inch and a half long.
But the reason I ask is novelists will tell you there really is a different mindset when you're writing a short story and when you're writing a novel. Do most playwrights even start with one acts the way writers often start off with short stories?
I love the one act and obviously have for years and years because for me. A one-act play is much more like a poem than it is like a play because it can depend on an image or just an explosion of emotion and can leave you. It can be 30 seconds long, as one of Samuel Beckett's best plays is. And I love that sort of subversive attacking from the rear, striking like lightning and fading into the sunset.
How does a one-act comedy differ from a comedy skit?
I always say that the difference is that in a play as opposed to a skit contains pain in some way. It may be emotional pain. It may be the pain in the audience of actually having to think about something. But it has to take you farther than the jokes.
I'd imagine not every actor has a special skill set to do a series of one acts in general, and yours in particular. What do you look for when you're casting?
I look for the people who are sitting in the studio with me.
They have to be able to do so many different things.
I mean, how many? We have 35 costumes, I think. How many is it? And 20
yeah,
wigs.
Per actor, it feels yeah. like.
And you're also taking off wigs and doing all sorts of other things.
Lots of quick changes.
We've got five wigs. Is that right? Six wigs?
So even when you're off stage, you're actually working, running around?
Uh-huh. Well, there's other people who are helping us. Way more than we're doing ourselves.
Well, this is not the first time either of you have appeared in a David Ives production of One X. Do they have a special appeal for some actors or all actors?
I think probably for all actors. But, I mean, yes, I think because David's plays especially have a great – they have so much heart and, like you said, so much pain. And the structure is always so great to latch onto. And he writes these amazing different kinds of characters that to be able to do an evening like this where you get to play – all kinds of different people in one evening. It's just,
that doesn't become confusing.
Well, during rehearsal it does.
But I think what's exciting about it, I think actors are always looking for good material, whether it's short material or long material or whether it's a 2.5-hour evening of Shakespeare or seven short plays by David Ives. You know, what we're looking for is we're looking for an opportunity to get out there and interact with each other and do something special. And David's work is special, and it allows us to really go to all kinds of places, like David said, places of hilarity and pain, and it's wonderful.
Well, the timing is very important in the scenes that depend on a lot of puns and wordplay. Is it hard not to laugh when you're doing one of those things?
Sometimes, yeah, for sure.
Do you get tripped up?
Well, sometimes. times.
Well, it's, you know, there's two things that can be challenging as it pertains to, you know, breaking or corpsing on stage. And it's one, if there's a flash of genius that happens in your fellow actor that's new, you know what I mean? And so something new and spontaneous happens, that can, you know, threaten your concentration. And the other is if the audience is so into it that they just start going on these waves and jags of laughter, it can be contagious. You want to, like, join them in the audience, yeah, rather than, you know, stay.
I feel weird invoking Laurence Olivier here, but he felt that you got the part down exactly during rehearsal and then you did it exactly the same every night. But most actors I've spoken to hate that idea.
No, that's absolutely repellent to me. Yeah. Like the idea. I mean, I'm not the same person that I was yesterday, and none of my characters.
Do you just suddenly hear a line differently in your head, as you say?
Yeah. And it's a biokinetic feedback loop. It's completely and totally alive every night. So this night's audience is going to tell us something different about the play than last night's audience, and we're going to learn from them and from each other.
Yeah, I think also, you know, you'll be in the middle of talking and suddenly something will mean something different. And you'll have this flash of, oh, I understand what this, all the different layers underneath this more than I did yesterday, you know.
Even when you're playing a washing machine.
Yeah, exactly.
I've always said that theater is the only art that gets smarter. And it partly gets smarter by actors listening to each other and listening to the audience. And it is truly an organic. It's an amoeba up there that you're watching spread and grow and correct itself, and it's an extraordinary experience.
Based on what actors have told me, I've always felt that I should try to see the next to last performance of a play. That's when actors say they really figured it all out.
But usually on the last performance, there's a lot of involuntary crying.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said the next to last.
Yeah, you know, the last is usually totally. Pretty bad.
I understand that the two of you have an excerpt from soap opera that you're prepared to do for us.
We do.
You want to set it up, Liv?
I'll set it up. Soap opera is a play that begins with a man dressed as a washing machine repairman entering a French restaurant, pushing a washing machine and asking for a table for himself and his companion. And at that point, he tells us the story of how he fell in love with a Maypole washing machine. And so Carson launches off into...
The Sphinx in our edible basement was my mother's Maypole, an old Neptune IT-40. It sat there like a mystical monolith, an ivory soap tower, one block in some Tower of Babel. Anyway, in our house, the Maypole was a god, week after week generating out of my miserable clay the radiant angels who oversaw my childhood as a walking magnet for filth. And here was the machine to cleanse me. We were a perfect match, and without a dryer to come between us. Then there was Mabel.
Mabel is a woman who's in love with the Maypole repairman, but he does not return her love because he's in love with the washing machine. And so she has a scene with him and leaves in tears and...
Mabel, come back.
Would you like a handkerchief?
A woman's head comes out of the machine.
Excuse me?
A handkerchief. It's immaculate, of course. We are a Maypole.
Oh, Mabel... Do you think she'll ever come back?
In my experience, everything's a cycle.
Oh, that handkerchief. It's pristine.
Because the molecules are now clean. Can Mabel scrub at the subatomic level?
I guess you don't think much of human beings.
We run hot and cold.
Of course.
Do humans ever bother to read the instruction manual?
I do. The manual is my messiah. It's my Emmanuel.
And your name is?
Manuel.
Maypoles don't need to read the good booklet. We know by nature how to run smoothly, noiselessly, and efficiently.
My God, you're beautiful.
Just beautiful?
Exquisite. Sublime.
Yes, we are. And we're a bit hungry. Would you feed us?
What would you like?
Don't you sometimes miss a little something in the wash?
You eat the socks.
Socks are sustenance. Under things are tastier.
Will BVDs do?
You're so sweet.
I was awash in confused feelings, but I sensed that this machine and I were locked in permanent press. And if it was love, it was unclean.
End of scene.
Now, David, where do the word plays come in? Are they there from the start? Are you thinking, gee, I thought of these, a couple of things like that, and maybe I'll do a play around it, or does they just come as you're writing them?
You know, this play kind of came out all in one rush. And so it just this play kind of wrote itself, except for one speech in the middle that I wrote during a rehearsal one day. But I actually, this was a play that I can name the very second when it began, because I was walking through downtown Independence, Kansas on a Sunday morning, totally deserted. And in the window of an ancient appliance store, they had the old poster of the Maytag repairman crying. And I stood in front of it and I thought, that is a play. I want to know that man's story. And so I just went home and I wrote it.
Now, David also writes an awful lot of reset plays. You've both appeared in some of them, haven't you?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, Sure Thing.
Sure Thing.
This is not the first time you've appeared in David Ives productions.
No.
What about that, like the Enigma variations? Can you explain that for us?
Anybody who can explain Enigma variations gets a prize.
Yeah, I was getting lost. I was saying something similar happened in A Sure Thing, which you performed together in All in the Timing, kind of a novel boy meets girl scene. And that was way before Constellations and even Interstellar. They all required such quick timing, especially when you're talking together with another actor. You said that rehearsals can get rather messy.
Well, I think with Sure Thing specifically,
really,
you know, the specificity, the language that David uses in that, and the way that it does jump back and then move forward. And what he does is he uses like a series of sentences that are exactly the same before it takes a right or a left turn. So when that bell goes and you reset, sometimes he'll do like a little clue, like, excuse me, is this seat taken? That happens four times. But in the middle, there's a, excuse me, is this chair taken? And it's almost as if David's hidden a little marker in there so that the actor can kind of go, okay, where am I again? And, you know,
when two more to go.
Yeah. And, well, Liv and I, you know, in the first or second preview of All in the Timing, we did fall out of sequence with the play, and we ended up in a, you know, some sort of crazy Enigma variation
interstellar
loop. And it is terrifying until you really do have a technical mastery of the play and where you are inside of it. It can be very challenging.
Yeah, I think, well, in this play, too, I think we've had, all of us have had moments in Enigma variations that it just, we're all holding on for dear life. You know, what comes next? What am I supposed to?
Yeah, there's four chairs and four actors white-knuckling it in those chairs, trying to hold on for dear life with the
and
language.
Yet I should tell anybody who comes to see the show that one of the wonders of Enigma variations and one of the things I wait for is that the actors have a section in the middle that they change every night, and they do it on their feet, and it is a wonder to watch.
You improvise it?
Sort of. I mean,
the words are the same.
The words are all the same.
The accents may change.
The accents change, and we're sort of playing with each other. It's so much fun.
I'm speaking with two of the cast members of David Ives' latest production, which is Lives of the Saints, a collection of six short plays. Currently at the Duke on 42nd Street. It's running through March 27th. With me are David Ives and Carson Elrod and Liv Ruth. The first half of the evening before the intermission is very different from the second half. When did you write what would be the title one act, Lives of the Saints?
Lives of the Saints is, well, I should say that the six plays that comprise the evening are three new plays and three plays that are a little older. In Lives of the Saints, the title play is, I would say, about 15 years old, and it is my favorite play of any play I've ever written. I don't think it's my best play, but necessarily, but it's my favorite play.
Dedicated to your mother.
Dedicated to my mother. It's about two, I suppose loosely you could say it's about two Polish-American women making a funeral breakfast for a friend's husband in a church basement. But it's all done with sound effects. And it's kind of a high wire act for two actors and some actors who do the sound effects. It's a play that's very near to my heart. And so I came back to it and was afraid to look at it again. And we have two actresses who are sublime in it, Liv and Kelly Hutchinson.
That's my favorite one to do in the whole evening, I would say.
Well, you definitely are playing a very different character than you.
Yes.
Most of the other characters you play are rather glamorous.
<That's right.
laughs> She is not glamorous.
No,
but hadn't you said at one point that you weren't going to return to the short format, and here you are with it?
You've caught me out. I did say that, and I've said so many things, and you didn't know that.
No,
I've said so many things in my life and gone back on them, and the one-act play is one. I thought that without a venue for them and without any ideas for them, I was finished, and I was enjoying doing French 18th century plays and couplets. And then I just started getting ideas, and I started writing them. And three of the plays in this evening are very new, and oddly enough, they were the ones that took the least work as we were rehearsing. It was the older plays that took some massaging. The shelf life of a play being about 3 days, as you know.
And why did they require massaging?
It's just that time does its job on plays in a way that it doesn't on paintings or dances or pieces of music, and things go out.
Well, isn't that where the director comes in?
Yes, and we have the brilliant John Rando, who is bottled, unbottled champagne.
Yeah, he really is.
Liv, you appeared in Broadway in Venus and Fur.
I did.
Are David's lines always David's lines, or
yes.
Is there a difference?
No, they are. It's very unmistakably David Ives. And I always tell people it's amazing because he can. It's amazing that all those things come out of your brain and onto the page, but it has this undercurrent of such truth, and also the magnified quality of humanity.
And then you were also lucky that Roman Polanski wasn't directing it.
Yeah, that's right.
I should mention that Liv did Venus and Fur in Hartford,
in Connecticut,
opposite her then fiancé.
Yes,
so.
My now husband. I did.
Wow, you survived.
I did. We were really
wonderful.
I hope
the power dynamic is a little different in your marriage.
I said to Liv after she'd done it, so Liv, how was it? And she said, it was great.
It was great. We had a great time.
Carson, people have seen you in some non-David Ives plays, like Peter and the Starcatcher. You did both Broadway and off?
I did the original production at New York Theater Workshop and then went to Broadway with it, yeah.
And then you were in The Merry Widow at the Met, the
opening
of the season.
I was just there. It was absolutely fantastic.
Susan Stroman.
Yeah, so exciting. Who is also unbottled champagne.
David, you're currently, you talk about unbottled champagne. You're currently working on something with Stephen Sondheim, aren't you?
That's what the newspapers tell me, so it must be true. Yes, we're working.
La da 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 da. I'm sorry. I just wanted people to know
start?
That I sang. I just wanted that to be on record.
Just audition.
I'm sorry.
I guess, he writes the most clever lyrics for his songs, and you're very clever. Are you going to write lyrics for the songs?
No, I wouldn't presume. I'm writing the book.
Project. Louis Buñuel movies made into musicals?
Two Louis Buñuel movies. Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie is part one. And then the same characters go on to The Exterminating Angel in part two. So they're searching for dinner in the first part, and they get it and can't get away from it in the second part, which is, you know, such a beautiful structure. How could we not?
Although, you know, if somebody said to me, name a filmmaker who would provide good material for a musical, Louis Buñuel would not be the first one to come to mind.
Oh, wait till you see. But I remember reading about the first announcement of Sweeney Todd about a butcher, about a barber who butchers his customers and eats them, and I thought, oh, there's a great idea for a play.
What's it like to be performing in this theater? It's a new theater, so the audiences love it because the seats are at
kind of stadium seating a little bit.
Yeah.
And very comfortable seats as well.
I really enjoy it. I mean, you know, black box theaters and the off-Broadway theater scene in New York City is very unique in that you do have these intimate spaces in which you don't have to, you know, do a kind of loud, over-acty, yelling type of performance where, you know, it's really lovely to be intimate and real, and you certainly can in a theater of 200 seats.
Although the people might get lost trying to find it. It's on 42nd Street on the big strip. Somewhere between a McDonald's and a
yes, yeah, it's hidden
and
on the
King's.
Second floor. Yeah, it's hidden on the second floor of the new 42 rehearsal spaces. You know, if you find the American Airlines Theater, you've found us.
Yes,
we
right
welcome
next
people coming from McDonald's.
That's
yes.
right.
Now it's running until what did I say? March 27th. Is that it for sure?
I don't know. I think, well, we can always extend, but we open tonight, actually.
Yes, we do.
This is opening night, so we're all kind of fired up today.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen it in preview then. Probably should have waited to see better performances.
You wanted March 26th would have been the day
right.
to come.
My great thanks to all of you for being on our show. David Ives, Carson Elrod, Liv Ruth, and Lives of the Saints, currently at this wonderful theater, The Duke on 42nd Street. Ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org. Are you feeling a little under the weather? Maybe you have an unusual rash or a lump on your side, on the side of your neck. When something like that happens, most people turn to the internet for some clue as to what might be going on. And although self-diagnosing an illness online may not supply all of the right answers, we usually assume it's confidential. Not true, says Brian Merchant, senior editor for Vice's Science and Tech Channel Motherboard. It turns out that an astonishing number of the pages that we visit to learn about our health concerns are sending our data to third-party corporations, all for profit. We have a link to Brian's article on our show page at WNYC.org, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Let's begin by talking about cold sores. If someone types that into a search engine and then clicks on the WebMD or CDC link for more information, what happens?
Well, what happens is your search is not going to be as private as you might have thought it would be. So when you click, and now it's a little bit different, whether you're clicking on a for-profit corporation like WebMD or a nonprofit like CDC, but either way, that information about your search and your data is going to be broadcast to a number of outside parties that will often include specific data about the nature of your symptoms. So if you're searching for cold sores and you click on that WebMD link, Tim Leibert, who did the research that kind of uncovered this mass privacy breach, says that WebMD is quote-unquote calling up everybody in town and saying, look, this is what you're looking at. So
when you say everybody in town, who are we talking about?
I'm talking about Google. I'm talking about Twitter. I'm talking about Facebook. I'm talking
about Experian as well.
So Experian, a big credit broker, a big online data broker who kind of traffics in this kind of business, makes money collecting data and selling it to banks and tinkering with your credit score. So Experian was found on 5% of all health search sites that you click on, so thousands and thousands and thousands. It's on WebMD. It's on a number of other popularly trafficked websites, sites that people assume are safe. So WebMD is basically saying, hey, you're searching for herpes. You're searching for whooping cough. And they're shipping that data right out to Experian.
And they send it to 34 separate domains.
That's right. That's right.
Is that data being used to tailor ads or is it being sold directly?
Well, that's the interesting thing is we really don't know what's going on with this data. We know that it can be collected. We know that it's perfectly legal for it to be collected under the current legal regime. But we don't know exactly what companies are doing with it because there's no oversight right now.
Okay, so somebody who has some concern goes to the CDC website. That information winds up in the hands of Google or another third party. Now, why would the CDC, which is a government organization, are they selling it?
So that's the interesting thing, is that there's really no nefarious intent here, or not even any profit motive. What happens is companies like Google, Twitter, and Facebook will offer these quote-unquote free products that help web developers install elements on their pages to do various things. So Google offers a very, very popular product called Google Analytics that if you plug that into the back end of your website, it will tell you crucial data about where users are coming from, where they're going within your site, how often they're visiting, and so on and so forth.
Stuff that CDC would want, and they're happy that it's being offered free.
Right, and they're happy that it's being offered for free, and they're not really paying attention to the fact that Google's doing this because they then get all that data. It gets broadcast to them as well every time that you visit the CDC. Now, Google may or may not be interested in whether or not you have a cold sore, but they have that data. They can ascertain it because they're also, along with that click, getting your IP address, identifying information about your computer, and they could very easily put it together.
But if I look up an illness, how do they know I actually have it? Couldn't I be looking it up because I'm curious, because somebody else I know may have it, or just as general research as part of producing a radio show?
Right. So, again, it speaks to the fact that we really don't know what they're doing with this or how closely they're watching. The thing that we do know is that if they wanted to really spend some time, and if you did worry about cold sores, you're probably going to Google them over and over more than something else. If, you know, a one-off curiosity, they might be able to find the signal in that noise. We just don't know for sure. But what we're really worried about is not so much whether or not Google can tell whether we're sick or not, but about these sort of extenuating circumstances that down the line, someone like Experian, which already has information about your lending practices, maybe your student loans. And
yeah,
they
thought it was a credit bureau.
Yeah.
Why would they want to know about whether I have some medical condition?
Right. Well, again, we don't know for sure. We can speculate, but I talked to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and one of their representatives told me, say, imagine that you're a bank and somebody's applying for a loan. And suddenly you have access to this information. Oh, well, this person may have a chronic illness. And because some 60% of bankruptcies are related to medical causes or medical bankruptcies, that's maybe an important indicator that this guy is not going to be able to pay his loan. And it's intrusive and it's invasive and it's perhaps discriminatory. But they said, yeah, for sure, this is something that we could maybe expect to happen in the future.
And there are no privacy laws protecting us?
There are no privacy laws protecting this user side. These searches are all sort of being volunteered by the user. Now, in 1996, there was a law enacted called HIPAA that protected patients' electronic medical records from being shared by doctors and the government. So on that side, we're covered. HIPAA prevents the government from making public your private medical data. But on these online search things, it's basically tracking our behavior on our side. There's nothing.
Because in the other case, the doctor is supplying it. In this case, we're actually supplying it ourselves.
Right. It's a whole new frontier.
Yeah. You mentioned Google more than once. Why are they a major player here?
Well, they're the...
I mean, I from what you say in your article, even if I'm not using Google, Google somehow finds out.
Google is everywhere. On the modern internet, Google is everywhere. If you're not using Google as a search engine, you might be using it for your email. You might be encountering it, again, on the back end of all these pages. So Google Analytics was installed in 45% of the 80,000 health sites that he...
But if I go to Yahoo, Google's still going to get that information?
It is, because Google Analytics might be installed on whatever site that you click on the back end. It's installed on 45% of all of these sites that Tim Leibert analyzed. So its elements were installed on 78%, I believe. The vast majority of all of these trackers are owned by Google, which means that one company has access to all this health data.
Now, Google has said that the reason that they track some of those things is just simply to give us better ads, which is actually information that we might need if we have some concern.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Is that fair?
Well, it's...
Are we being naive?
Well, I mean, I think it's a trait. We have to think about how much data we want to volunteer, how much we're willing to keep stored about us. There are, you know, the only major real-life incident that we can point to of this happening is in Canada, a man who was suffering from sleep apnea started to Google sleep apnea medical devices, things that could help alleviate his symptoms. Before long, he started noticing that he was getting targeted for sleep apnea ads. And he said, well, this is kind of creepy. These ads are following me around. So he submitted the complaint to Canada's Privacy Commission. And sure enough, they found that Google had violated the laws by
Canadian laws.
Canadian laws, not U.S. laws. Again, this is legal in the U.S. But Canadian companies are not allowed to volunteer medical information about consumers. And that's what Google had done to inform these advertisers that then started targeting him with health ads.
And what happened? He won a court case, didn't he?
Well, yes. They did determine that Google broke the law, and Google basically took the slap on the wrist and said, well, we probably shouldn't have volunteered all this. But ultimately, it was the advertiser's fault for violating the laws. It was their choice to run these ads, but we will make some adjustments to our policies.
Is part of the problem that we keep on hearing many members of Congress aren't very tech savvy, and so they would not see this as a concern, or is it just simply a matter of they don't want to regulate anything? They don't want to regulate whether I bring a gun into a kindergarten.
Well, I think that it's both. I think that the vast majority of Congress, as it stands right now, is woefully uneducated on the tech policy issues. And there are a handful that do a good job. But again, I think you're right. Even if they were educated, I don't know that they would have the wherewithal to regulate something like this at this juncture.
My guest is Brian Merchant, who's a senior editor for Vice's Science and Tech channel called Motherboard. And we are talking about how so many things that we think are private interactions with us and some online service turn out to be anything but private. You write about a company called MedBase 200, which was reported as using proprietary models to generate and sell lists with classifications such as rape sufferers, domestic abuse victims, and HIV/AIDS patients. Are these lists being compiled to sell ads?
That was the goal of that one, and that was a pretty ugly example. Thankfully, that, to my knowledge, has been shut down, but it just really shows you the potential of what's out there. I mean, yeah, that data is out there. They can collect, lists of people who are suffering from certain ailments, people who have psychological traumas, people who have really suffered, and they can sell that to data brokers and advertisers.
And it can be linked to my Facebook?
Well, Facebook is one of the biggest depositories of information. Facebook is learning an awful lot about all this stuff.
Well, what would Facebook want to know about whether somebody was or had been raped or suffered from domestic abuse? You don't put that on your face page.
Well, Facebook isn't interested in it per se, except for that it, again, gives
your profile,
you
profile. I'm sorry. I'm showing my age here.
Yeah. No, they're learning more things about you. And again, I don't think Facebook would really want anybody to target ads to those demographics, but they're the filter through which other third parties can learn those things.
Now, we mentioned the CDC, but there are any number of government sites, nonprofits, and universities that also are sharing this information, you say inadvertently.
Yeah.
The Mayo Clinic, Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Who else?
Yeah. There are hundreds of them. Anybody that has installed Google Analytics, Facebook buttons, add this popular back-end software that is convenient and free, anybody that has installed that is inadvertently coughing up this data.
And you report that this extends to places that aren't even health sites, like Merriam-Webster, Free Dictionary,
yeah,
and eHow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think one of the most important takeaways from this research is that this is just one corner of an example of how the internet works. This is just one example. This is happening everywhere. All websites, certainly all commercial websites, many, many government websites.
Well, you say websites. Not Wikipedia. That's an exception.
But not Wikipedia. You almost have to make a concerted effort not to install elements that will track you. Organizations like Wikipedia do a great job. They were one of the only organizations who ran websites that consistently did not track users. So if you're sick and you're going to Google symptoms, Wikipedia is your best bet, probably.
Cold sore wiki.
Yeah.
But, so it's being sold to these third parties who then package them and sell them to other places. But are they all being stored safely, or can they also be hacked?
Well, I should point out that we're not sure that it's being sold. We just know that it's being broadcasted.
Well,
and
somebody's
most
paying for them, so somebody is seeing these as profit areas.
Right. That is an assumption. And no, we have no idea whether it's being securely stored or not. All these searches that you've done about your private health condition are sitting somewhere on a server, very possibly. And yeah, we have no idea how securely that data is being stored. You know, Google is very assertive and states very emphatically that they are not sharing this data with anybody else, that they're keeping good care of it. But ultimately, it's up to us to trust them. And I don't know if that's a position that we want to be in.
And I don't recall signing up for this.
Well, you did when you signed up for your Gmail account.
So when I did that thing where they gave me 85 pages in 5-point type, what I used to call mice type when I was in the advertising business, and then finally I go blind trying to read it all, I just hit agree at the end. I've agreed to this?
More or less. Again, there's a lot of legal gray area here. And, you know, there's still a lot, you know, to be worked out. And as you said, Congress is very reluctant to address these issues. But there are a lot of unresolved matters in this frontier that we really need to be tackling in coming days.
A listener wonders whether apps like Ghostery can stop this kind of data collection.
Ghostery is great. And yes, they can help a great deal. They still may not be 100% effective. It's very difficult to be at 100% effective because the amount of data that's being collected between your browser fingerprint, any cookies you may generate, other browsing history, you know, a persistent company may be still able to put it together, but Ghostery is certainly a definite recommendation. It will keep you private most of the time.
Because there are all sorts of cookies we're not even aware or have remained in our computers.
That's right. Yeah.
And we're back to Google with a lot of those cookies.
A lot of them, yeah. And I mean, I would be remiss to state that like there are a lot of positive benefit. I mean, Google is you know, says it's tracking you and earnestly believes that it's tracking you to improve your user experience. You're going to get better searches, et cetera, with all this information. But again, it comes down to the user, to us, to decide how much of that information we want to volunteer. How much is convenience worth to us?
A listener also wonders, so even if you search with a non-tracking search engine like DuckDuckGo, the page you go to from the search results could have Google Analytics tracking you from that page?
That's right, yes.
Now, you mentioned that all of this was discovered by a researcher named Tim Liebert. How did he even get into this, and how did he determine what was happening?
Well, Tim actually built a custom software called Web X-Ray specifically for this purpose, so that he could analyze large swaths of websites at a time and find out which elements they had installed that were tracking. So, you know, they vary from day to day, month to month, as developers install and uninstall new plugins. But this software allowed him to really analyze 80,000 sites within 1 month, April 2014 of last year.
Does he say he was surprised by what he discovered?
He was really surprised.
It's pretty big.
Yeah. I think the two things that surprised him the most, I mean, you'll have to ask him, but I think he was surprised just the vast ubiquity of how many tracking agents that Google had installed. He said he knew that Google was going to be big, but he didn't know how big. And two, he said he was really surprised to see Experian showing up as much as it did. Because as he says, here's this company that's in charge of monitoring my credit score. It knows my student loans, and now it knows if maybe I'm sick.
I'm assuming Axion and some of the other big companies as well.
Same, yeah.
So how do we get around this? Do we just not check up on anything that we are so addicted to going to Google or some other search engine to find out this kind of information?
Yeah, so.
It may not be in the latest edition of a book that we can buy.
Right. So my advice, personally, would be three-tiered. One, use Wikipedia and other non-tracking websites.
Although Wikipedia isn't always as accurate as you would like.
It's surprisingly accurate a lot of the time. It, you know, it's as accurate as maybe your typical encyclopedia. But two, use Ghostery. or Privacy Badger, which is the EFF's ad blocker. And three, if you're really concerned about this, we really have to really yell at Congress. We have to make noise. You have to say, listen, this is important. The web is seeping into more and more and more of our lives. And if we want to be sure that we're going to be able to keep things like our personal medical data private, we have to fight for that.
There's no web neutrality here.
Yeah.
Brian Merchant is a senior editor for Vice's Science and Tech Channel Motherboard. Thank you so much for scaring the heck out of me today.
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
And now for something completely different.
Hello, my name is Daniel Handler. I'm the author of the novel We Are Pirates, among too many other books, including many under the name Lemony Snicket. Cool. I'm pleased to be back here in a mysterious building in downtown New York, where public radio is made. Won't you pledge now? Operators are standing by, and these people that I'm with look broke. Flat broke. Pledge now or just send a, you know, basket of mini muffins. Who do I read? Well, I write a column for the Believer magazine called What the Swedes Read, in which I read one book by each Nobel Prize winner, which I'm excited about. So lately I've been reading people from around the world, including Paul Heyse, who's my favorite German novelist in the 1920s right now. I'm also, when I'm on a book tour, I like to read poetry. And indeed, on this book tour I've been on, for each bookstore appearance, I have been reading with a poet. So I've been bringing their work with me. I've been reading T.J. Jarrett, who's a great poet out of Nashville, Mary Jo Bang, St. Louis's own Mary Jo Bang, I should say, Rodney Konecki, Matthew Zapruder, Victoria Chang. There's some great poets in America, and I get to hang out with them one night of my life. It feels like a win-win, because if many people come to the event, then many people hear the great poetry of our poets, and if not a lot of people come, then I get to be drunk with the poet. Either way, everyone wins. I write in my office, or in a library, or in selected cafes. My rule for the cafe is that it has to have very strong coffee and terrible food, so that I don't say, why don't I just treat myself to one of their delicious salads, that instead I say, I've been working so hard, I must eat something, I guess I'll have this terrible $2 banana. What else? I write longhand on legal pads. I'm a big fan of writing in longhand because you don't have to make up your mind right away. You can cross a word out, but it's still kind of there. And then also when you're in a cafe or a library and you need to get up and pee because you're drinking green tea constantly, then you don't have to worry about your legal pad being stolen. Unlike your laptop, which you either have to ask a stranger to watch, weird, or take it with you into the bathroom, also weird. Oh, I read a great number of pirate histories and pirate novels. I watched some pirate films until my wife finally said that if she saw Errol Flynn on her screen one more time, she was going to lose her mind. Yeah, I tried to figure out all of the hallmarks of the pirate genre. The novel is about some people in our present-day world who try to become pirates in the classic swashbuckly mode, and I wanted to make sure that all the swashbuckly tropes were being taken care of. Any last things you should know about me? These are the last things anyone's going to know about me? Wait a minute. I want to read the fine print on the book club. And then we kill him. Then we kill the author. The end. Yes, thank you for coming, book clubbers. You won't get that out of Franzen.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.